Let me move on to introducing both Aidan and Christy. Aidan Hare is director of the Security and International Relations Program at the University of Westminster. He has published widely on humanitarian intervention, state building, the prevention of genocide, and in particular, the responsibility to protect. He's the author of a recent book called The Responsibility to Protect that was published in 2011 or 2012. 2012. Yes, here it says 2012. Rhetoric, Reality, and the Future of Humanitarian Intervention, which forms the basis for some of his remarks today. But he's also written about humanitarian intervention more broadly, an introduction that's used a lot in teaching and research on the subject, but also specifically on debates after Kosovo, his book Humanitarian Intervention After Kosovo, published in 2008. He's also the assistant editor of the Journal of Intervention and State Building, which some of you will be aware of, and a senior lecturer in international relations at the University of Westminster. Now, Christy, or I should use her formal name, but we know her as Christy, Ann Kristen Rashdorf, has been a visiting fellow at ELAC last year, and it was a great experience for us to have Christy with us. She is serving now as a political affairs officer with UNAMI in Baghdad, and she spent her sabbatical from February to June last year here, where she was looking at a comparative study on U.S. peacekeeping operations with a focus on issues related to peacekeeping and R2P. She has a long track record with the United Nations, having worked for the United Nations Assistant Mission for Afghanistan, UNAMA, and Sierra Leone, and also worked for the ICTR in Arusha and Kigali. Before joining the UN, she had positions with the OSCE and NGOs in Palestine, Kosovo, Bosnia, Sierra Leone, and Rwanda. Christy has spent lots of time in a number of interesting countries, which we've discussed at ELAC. So the way that Aidan and Christy are going to divide up the discussion is Aidan's going to talk more generally about the development of the concept of responsibility to protect and the challenges with its operationalization. And his critique is really based, I'll let him tell you more, but on some of the difficulties with translating moral intentions into practice. R2P was essentially designed to address problems of inaction and inconsistency, and Aidan asked questions about whether it succeeded in doing that. Whereas Christy's going to look more at more scholarly critical approaches to studying and understanding the responsibility to protect. And she takes, I think, a less critical stance than Aidan in some respects. She wants to continue to keep normative ideas at the heart of R2P, but she also offers us a framework drawn from critical theory for thinking about R2P. So we'll start with Aidan. They're each going to speak for about 20 minutes, and then I'm sure you will have questions for them. So Aidan, if you want to begin.
Great. Thank you very much, Jennifer, for the invite. It's great to be here, and thank you all for coming today. Before I get into it, I always feel I have to kind of start by saying I'm not a pessimistic guy. I often feel, particularly, well, Jennifer and I were on a round table or a panel of some kind in San Diego earlier this year, and certainly afterwards a lot of people were saying, God, you're so cynical, you're so negative, you're so pessimistic, this kind of thing. And I'd like to think that I'm not, in terms of my disposition, but certainly when it comes to R2P, I would certainly agree. I'm quite critical of it, and I don't believe it's going to achieve an awful lot, or has achieved an awful lot. And in that sense, I suppose I'm very obviously standing in sharp contrast to people like Gareth Evans. And there's a quote from Gareth Evans that I like to read out quite a lot. He says, R2P has made contributions that seem likely to have a lasting impact. And he describes it as a brand new international norm of really quite fundamental importance and novelty that is unquestionably a major breakthrough. And it's this type of language and this type of rhetoric that tends to, I suppose, inspire me would be the word to write about R2P. And particularly as well after the intervention in Libya, when Ban Ki-moon and, you know, dozens of other people greeted this with great fanfare, and Ban Ki-moon said, R2P has arrived. And from my point of view, looking at R2P and its record, I believe we have to judge it on its impact on state behaviour not on whether or not it has become ubiquitous in international political discourse. I don't think the fact that it is a popular term is indicative of its efficacy. I think the two things have to be separated. And just to start, what I'd like to do is just to try and contrast why R2P was established in the first place, why the International Commission on Intervention State Sovereignty, the ISIS Commission, why that was established in the first place, to compare that with R2P today. Now, if we think about the ICISS Commission, it came at the end, obviously, of the 1990s. It was established in the wake of the question, the famous question that Kofi Annan asked in 1999 after the intervention in Kosovo. And really, it was born from the inconsistent responses in the 1990s to humanitarian, interstate humanitarian crises. Most obviously manifest, I think, in 1994, where there was a Chapter 7 mandated intervention to deal with the situation in Haiti, but there wasn't with respect to Rwanda. And this problem of what Simon Chesterman described as inhumanitarian non-intervention. You know, a lot of people, a lot of critics of humanitarian intervention, and I'm certainly not a critic of humanitarian intervention, but a lot of critics feared we were going to have constant intervention. It was just, you know, an imperialist plot, which I don't agree with. And Chesterman, who I do agree with, said the problem isn't too many interventions. The problem is, you know, the proliferation of inhumanitarian non-intervention. Okay? And additionally, in tandem with that inconsistent response, was the problem of unilateral intervention, action without the Security Council, and that was obviously Kosovo. So the issue wasn't with sovereignty, wasn't with the laws governing the use of force with respect to the principle of defending or looking after your own citizens. The notion that states have an internal responsibility wasn't necessarily all that contentious. And this was reflected in Kofi Annan's reflective report on Rwanda, where he said the problem with Rwanda wasn't that we didn't have the legal means to intervene. The problem was, as he said, the failure to intervene was driven more by the reluctance of member states to act. Mm-hmm. Not that we didn't have laws, or not that the government in Rwanda claimed the right to do whatever it wanted to its own people. So ultimately, if that is the nature of the problem, I believe we can localise, we can focus it into one particular issue, which is the influence of politics on law enforcement, and essentially the P5. The fact that the permanent five members of the Security Council have this enormous power, but no duty to act. Hence this inconsistent record. Now, R2P, from that basis, has emerged. Okay, what has it become today? Well, it has instituted no change in the laws governing the use of force. It has instituted no change in the institutions charged with enforcing the laws, certainly no duty to act, and the veto power of the P5 remains. That's the legal side of it. In terms of the strategic side of it, then, the strategy has been of creating moral norms and exercising leverage through global civil society and popular advocacy. The notion that if we can, you know, get this term widely used, it will create a normative pressure that the P5 and other states simply cannot resist. And a second side of that strategy, which I don't have time to talk about today, what has been this increased focus on prevention. It's not really about reaction, actually. You know, it's really about prevention. That was the thing we always wanted to emphasise. And I've said elsewhere, I think that's evasion. The result of that, however, the result of the strategy and the lack of legal change, I think has been manifest with respect to the Arab Spring. And with respect to Syria, I think it's very clear. To have a system where the UN Secretary General and Kofi Annan as a special envoy to Syria end up both pleading with the Security Council to do something is an embarrassment. And is, you know, degrades the international system. It's embarrassing for the UN, it's embarrassing for international law. If we look at how the situation has been dealt with at the Security Council, on two occasions, China and Russia have both cast double vetoes against very modest action. No, there wasn't a proposal to intervene militarily in Syria. These were very modest proposals to do something about what was happening in Syria. And even that was too much for China and Russia. So we end up with this spectacle of the UN Secretary General and the Special Envoy pleading for action, the Security Council simply not taking action, and then we have the chorus of outrage from non-governmental organisations. Now that surely is very reminiscent of Bosnia in 1992 and of many humanitarian crises which predate R2P. And in that sense, I think it's right to ask, well, what has changed? The problem in the Arab Spring, I think, is very clear. Why we've had this inconsistent response, intervention in Libya, non-intervention in Syria. It's the P5, essentially. Okay? The reason for intervention in Libya was that Gaddafi had alienated himself so much from the Arab League, in particular from the Saudi royal family, that he'd no friends left there. The Arab League despised Gaddafi personally and were in favour of getting rid of his regime and were in favour of the no-fly zone. And if you read the explanations regarding the chronology of that particular intervention, all the key players, particularly Hillary Clinton, say when the Arab League called for intervention, that was the game changer. That meant we couldn't be seen to resist intervention in the face of the Arab League calling for intervention. Now, why did the Arab League call for intervention in Libya? Surely it wasn't because they have a concern for human rights, given how they reacted to the situation in Bahrain. So we have a situation there where we can identify why there was intervention in Libya, which has much to do with geopolitics within that particular region. Why was there no intervention in Syria? Again, I don't think you have to be a genius to point to the fact that particularly Russia's links with Syria has shielded Syria from outside intervention. Why was there very, very little international criticism of Bahrain and what Bahrain was doing, what the Bahrain monarchy was doing? Again, because Bahrain, very close ties with Saudi Arabia, the United States and the West more generally do not want to go against Saudi Arabia in that particular region, and hence the situation of Bahrain, where you have outside intervention, but outside intervention from the Gulf Cooperation Council to support the Bahrain government in putting down the protesters, is met essentially with silence at the international level. So that's the practical result of R2P. Inconsistency, where you have an intervention in Libya, but no intervention in Syria, and essentially political considerations determining how the international community responds to interstate crises. Now, in that sense, we have to confront this notion, which is invariably put forward, that because R2P is discussed widely and is widely used and has made this remarkable transition from being a kind of a abstract academic notion in 2000 and 2001 to becoming a key rhetorical term in international political discourse, that in itself does not evidence its efficacy. Ed Luck has a quote about this where he talks about the amount of PhD theses that have been written about R2P and the amount of books that
in
have
this
been,
university.
Yeah, well, I've written a book about R2P as well, but he says this is fantastic. You could fill a small library with these things, as though that, again, in itself is evidence that something good is emerging here. But beyond just the fact that academics and PhD students are writing about R2P, it certainly has also entered into international political discourse. Nobody could deny that. However, the question I would ask is, why would any state not support the responsibility to protect? It's not actually all that controversial. If you look at the 2009 General Assembly debate on the responsibility to protect, if anybody has the time to read all the various different submissions made by the states at that debate, they're fascinating. Not so much because of what Western states say about it, but if you read what North Korea, what Iran, and what Sudan say about the responsibility to protect, they're effusive. Old responsibility to protect is fantastic. The Sudanese statement on R2P goes into social contract theory, the need for the government to be responsive to the citizens, etc., etc. Of course, the very same government that's been indicted by the ICC that perpetrated massacres routinely in Darfur. States can very easily nod their heads and say, yes, we like R2P, precisely because it's inherently vague. I describe it in my book as the agreement in 2005 as a triumph of the lowest common denominator. Okay, the one achievement that I would accept is the constitutional achievement in 2005 was situating R2P as being focused only on the four crimes listed. Beyond that, however, I don't see that there's an awful lot there to celebrate. Where are the thresholds? Where is there anything about duties? It's so vague that essentially it amounts to a rhetorical commitment. We promise to behave internally, and we also stand ready to act if citizens in our states need help. However, if rhetorical commitments to protect one's own citizens and even citizens abroad, based on a system of self-regulation, was sufficient, then we would never have needed R2P, because we've had that system for decades, if not centuries. If you look at the first part of it, the internal responsibility of states, states have very, very rarely, if ever, suggested, particularly in the post-charter era, we can do whatever we want internally. If you look at the number of international agreements states have signed since 1945, prescribing genocide, racial discrimination, torture, etc., etc., states are more than happy to put their hands up and say, we accept we can't do certain things internally. Whether they actually enforce that, of course, is another matter. After 2005, Tony Blair said, for the first time at this summit, we agreed that states do not have the right to do what they will within their own borders. But that's simply untrue. Ban Ki-moon, for example, said, R2P rests on long-standing obligations under international law. Anybody who's, you know, even had a cursory glance at international law regarding human rights will see that prior to 2005, there was dozens, if not hundreds, of laws saying states cannot do certain things internally. The problem wasn't the absence of laws or rhetorical commitments. The problem was enforcing these internally. In terms of the external aspect of R2P, we will intervene if you don't adhere to the internal. Again, the 1990s demonstrated time and time again that there was a legal means for intervention, Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. Okay? A number of times the Security Council said what's happening internally is a humanitarian disaster that we can't stand idly by and just watch. Resolution 794 passed in 1992 on Somalia justified intervention on the basis of the magnitude of the human tragedy and the deterioration of the humanitarian situation. This is in 1992. In the course of the debate about how to respond to Somalia, Russia said it supported intervention because it claimed it had an obligation to put an end to the human tragedy in that country. Now that's 1992, 20 years, you know, prior to the Arab Spring. Russia says it has an obligation. Now it's very easy to say that, obviously. I have an obligation. But then later on, I don't have any obligation and shy away from having any kind of a duty. Ultimately, in the 1990s, it was very clear that because of the capacity of the Security Council to occasionally reach agreement on how to act, there was a legal means to address internal crises. The problem was there was no duty, there was no automatic response. Hence, it became a question of, are our national interests involved? Now, what R2P advocates say is that, yes, we're addressing that. We're addressing that latter problem about the national interest because we're creating this normative momentum that these states simply cannot resist. Now, I think it's very important, you know, there's something to that. I mean, I don't discount normative evolution. Norms do inform laws. Laws don't, you know, fall from above. They come from contestation and they come from normative discussion. However, when we talk about norms, we need to be very clear about differentiating them from two things. Firstly, from political catchwords. Political catchword like the big society. I don't think you could call the big society a norm. I also need to differentiate between norms and common aspirations. Do we all want to make poverty history? Yes, we all want to make poverty history. Is make poverty history a norm, though? I don't think so. It's a common aspiration. A norm, and I'm using a quote here from Teresa Reinold, she says, an intersubjectively shared standard of appropriate behaviour. Not just an aspiration and not just a commonly used term. And if we look at norms, and particularly the people who write extensively about that, Finmore and Sink talk about the need to think seriously about the micro foundations on which theoretical claims about norms rest and evaluate those claims in the context of carefully designed historical and empirical research. Simply to say R2P is popular, everybody talks about it, hence it's a norm, just doesn't cut it. If we talk about norms as being more than just popular terms, and we look at, well, is there agreement? Is there this intersubjectively shared standard of appropriate behaviour? We look at what R2P is, and we see it's inherently nebulous. Okay? First of all, there's the problem reflected in this growing canon of literature on R2P, that R2P is absolutely everything. Okay? If you look at, you know, just type R2P into Amazon and see the book titles that come up. The responsibility to protect relating to the environment, climate change, the responsibility to protect relating to language. Everything is now an R2P issue. R2P always talked about prevention and the responsibility to rebuild and also reaction. But it's become so broad as to be essentially meaningless, you could say. There's nothing it doesn't cover. Looking more specifically then at its nebulous nature, where are the thresholds? When do we decide that this particular issue demands being moved from pillar one to pillar two or to pillar three, whatever it is? For example, with respect to Darfur, the sense was the first part of R2P is all about the primary responsibility being the host state. The primary responsibility, therefore, is with the Sudanese government. Let's let them get on with it. Okay? Now, that obviously wasn't the logic used with respect to Libya. It very quickly moved from being it's no longer possible to locate the primary responsibility with Libya, we have to jump in. Okay? But where is it clear when that happens? Additionally, the question has to be raised about what do states understand by R2P? Again, if you go back to the General Assembly debate in 2009 and read what China says about R2P, China supported R2P at the General Assembly debate in 2009. Compare what China says about R2P to what Sweden, the UK, the US say, and there are two very different understandings about R2P. How can we talk about it being a norm if we've two, if not more than two, different understandings of what that norm actually entails? Additionally, although the intervention in Libya was cited by many as the kind of the high water mark of R2P and the dawn of a new era, Jennifer, as I'm giving you a plug here, wrote an article about the intervention and mentioned a very important point here, that in Resolution 1973, there's no mention of the international community's responsibility to protect. There's a mention of Gaddafi's and Libya's responsibility to protect its own people. But the justification for intervention is not, we have a responsibility to protect people in Libya. And what Jennifer says about that, and I would agree, is that this is evidence of the fact that R2P is still contested by some members of the Security Council. Now, that was at the time of 1973 it was contested. Subsequently, there's evidence that R2P has become even more contested, because states that abstained on 1973 have said, if that's what R2P entails, we allow you to impose a no-fly zone, and you dramatically expand your understanding of what that means, then we're never going to sanction anything like that again. The suspicion about what R2P is has grown since 1973, and arguably so has the contestation surrounding its meaning. In that sense, its status as a norm is very, very contested. I would suggest it's not a norm at all. It's a term that's used. The fact that it doesn't have normative qualities therefore totally undermines the argument that it's a normative force that's forcing states to take certain action. And looking at this logic of championing moral norms over as the way to effect change, one of the key things that's reflected in the literature by advocates of R2P is almost an arrogant dismissal of international law and the need to reform international law. It tends to be something that not all, but the majority of R2P advocates simply just don't talk about. In 2009, I interviewed lots of NGOs in New York, R2P NGOs, and when I raised international law with them, it was almost like, why? Why are you talking about international law? We don't care about that. We're talking about normative momentum. And what I think is wrong with this is that it's born from an overinflated sense of global civil society's capacity to effect change. Okay? In the little bubble in New York, it seems everything is very exciting. We can do an awful lot of things, and we're having meetings constantly about R2P, and we're applying pressure all the time. Outside that, however, to what extent does this normative force, does global civil society really influence the P5? In particular, Russia. Is there any evidence that decisions made in Moscow are influenced by primarily Western non-governmental organizations championing R2P? Same goes for China. The same also has to be asked about Western states. At least two examples stand out which demonstrate the limitations of global civil society's capacity to effect change. One would be Darfur, where global civil society had a fantastically successful campaign in terms of generating, you know, press coverage and headlines. Couldn't have done more, even got George Clooney involved. However, action wasn't taken. You could also say about Iraq. Massive international protests against Iraq, huge protests in Washington, London, and yet the governments in those countries ignored what seemed to be the majority opinion and went ahead anyway. I think we have to be very careful about assuming that normative momentum, global civil society, reports by NGOs are going to change the disposition of states. And it's a strategy, I think, that derives from a kind of misplaced belief in a kind of a teleological understanding of history. Liberalism won the Cold War, it's the end of history, the spread of liberal values is irresistible, therefore law will eventually somehow catch up with morality. All we need to do is champion the right thing and it simply will come. There is a lack of a concrete strategy there. There is also a lack of understanding of why in the 1990s these types of issues suddenly gain prominence. There's a sense that this is now a new era that's going to last forever, the spread of the liberal Western view. The changing let's say, distribution of power in the international system, the rise of China, the rise of Russia, this tends not to be factored into the equation. How is that going to change the disposition at the Security Council, as these states, traditionally reluctant to embrace these types of norms, that clearly will have to have a negative influence on the capacity of these particular norms to actually, if they're norms at all,
2 minutes.
2 minutes to effect real change. Okay. In the book, I mention in the final chapter an essay by Reinhold Niebuhr called The Children of Darkness and the Children of Light. And he talks in that essay about why we have democracy and why we have laws. He says we have laws and we have democracy not because people are good, but because people can't be trusted. We need to have accountability. We need to have legal systems so that we can enforce laws to stop people taking advantage of them. And he describes as the children of light, those people who naively think that we can simply talk about the right thing to do and expect the right thing to happen on the basis of that. And in the book, I try to draw a parallel between R2P today and the children of light that Niebuhr talked about, in the sense that, granted, there are many good people, many very persuasive people out there who talk about the need to do the right thing, but they fail to understand the extent to which that has to be reflected in laws, particularly laws regarding the enforcement of human rights. When we get into the question of what should be done, which is, of course, one of the questions people invariably ask, to me, what we should be focusing on, those of us who want to see humanitarian intervention happen when necessary, is we need to discuss legal reform. This has been described by Ann Peters as the missing link in R2P. It just doesn't exist there. And that's what we need to talk about. Koskinimi, Hans Kelsen, people like that I've been reading a lot in the last year, they all talk about the current international legal system as being primitive, to use Hans Kelsen's word, precisely because of the problem at the latter end regarding enforcement. Not that there isn't sufficient number of laws or moral norms floating around, but the enforcement of these laws. And any functioning legal system has to have the means by which it can objectively enforce its laws. At the moment, we have a conflation between politics, national interest, and the enforcement of laws, which is the P5. To try to work with that system is a waste of time. Unless that system divorces political decision-making and national interest, because states will always have national interest, from the objective enforcement of laws such as that regarding internal respect for human rights and external action to protect human rights, we're going to be locked into this cycle of occasional interventions where everyone gets very excited, and more usually in humanitarian non-intervention. Just to close, what I would say about R2P is that it has chosen temporary fame over long-term effectiveness. It's granted, it's in the headlines, and many of its key players, like Gareth Evans, are, you know, widely, touted as sort of heroes and people that should be vaunted and respected. But that type of superficial fame and ubiquity in the long term is not going to solve the underlying problem. The underlying problem has to be and must be identified as the legal deficiency at the heart of the present system, the inability of the international legal system to enforce its own laws. And if we want to generate norms and normal momentum, that should be the norm that we proliferate. The norm of legal change is essential if we want to effect a positive change in the record of international responses to interstate crises. I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure there's lots that we can pick up on in questions from Aidan's remarks. And I've heard him give a couple of talks now, and this one was slightly different. So I always pick out something different, and I've got some questions of my own. Christy, would you like to go next?
Okay, we heard a lot about the normative efficacy being superficial. Now I'm trying to make in my presentation the point that normative efficacy is not superficial, but can be actually derived from the score of ethics. Like, I prepared a talk. I'm very sorry, I'm going to read this out. But I will make every effort to be intelligible. If you can't follow the argument, just raise your arm, and I know that I need to kind of slow down. Okay?
Okay.
Let me begin this presentation with some general observations.
You're okay.
On the evolution of expert discourses on intervention in state building and knowledge interest after 9/11. About 8 months ago, I followed with great interest the presentation of Dr. Leila Khalil from SOAC at ELAC, in which she outlined the multitude of ways in which counterinsurgency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan were gendered, and the manipulation and power relations this entailed, with dire consequences for all involved, both in terms of lack of truthful and meaningful interaction with host communities, civilian casualties, and credibility of international actors. A critique of distorted emancipatory peace-building practice was in particular directed at the US military and its normative strategy that suffered from a general paradox insofar as it simultaneously sought to defeat, assimilate, and engage, and hence was unable to maintain validity claims that would have been intelligible to the local population and other audiences, or upheld in internal ethics that would have prevented horrible transgressions such as Abu Ghraib.
Excuse me, could you speak up, please?
Yeah, we can't hear you, so
okay.
Well.
In its relentless search for additional resources of legitimization, it even sought to assimilate academic discourses. Her paper shone some light on the larger question why international forces were unable to win hearts and minds and secure a buy-in into a narrative of internal progress and cross-cultural cooperation that local populations could have trusted or internalized easily. From a peer perspective, it appears that this lack of common ground did not result from an imminent clash of civilizations or necessarily from a conflict between open, modern, and close traditional worldviews, as many had initially wanted to embrace change on their own cultural terms. In my view, it was more a consequence of an ongoing narrowing of parallel evolving worldviews that were in constant state of reinterpretation after 9/11 and left in the end less and less space for goodwill, cross-cultural dialogue, and humanitarian concerns that were added later into the equation only to discredit further the overall notion of humanitarianism and R2P globally. Competing collective needs to re-identification and restoration of liability certainty amidst ongoing violence resulted in competing narratives of cultural survival and a conservative backlash that Tom Engelhardt has described concisely in the case of the US through the phase post-legal society and the United States of fear. A term that captures well the prevailing state of mind of a nation so very different of that of Wilson or Roosevelt. As Chesterman notes, and I noticed he's one of your favorite, yeah. Afghanistan saw several rhetorical shifts in justification of international military practice best expressed in the names of US operations, whose meaning reached from reprisal to self-defense, to war on terrorism, and finally to a war against evil. It was a narrative exclusively tailored to a home audience that also sought to lobby Western support but not engage Afghans. In Chesterman's view, one of the central contradictions of an U.S. involvement in Afghanistan was that nation-building efforts were typically justified by reference to war on terror. But, or to put this in more to the point, in the light of his own need for consolidation, the U.S. did not concern itself with other integrative worldviews, which proved a very costly mistake, if one remembers, as Karl Deutsch has put it, that the creation of a security community is a function of social integration. The latter lies clearly with the cultural and legal domain, and not a systemic domain of foreign strategic interest. A good example to prove the forcefulness of this argument are the Iraqi Sahra councils, local security communities whose creation were a major factor in ending the insurgency in Iraq, a localized security initiative honoring the responsibility to protect. U.S. sentiment found, however, further application to the notion of terrorism that shaped perceptions of coalition partners in the West in the form of a powerful counter-narrative to cosmopolitanism of the 1990s. Overall, it left a scenario where, in the end, international actors were, and in the case of Afghanistan still are, looking for a dignified cut-off point to minimize their losses, leaving a normative void in terms of perceptional nation and state-building behind an integration task that Iraq has mastered, with the help of the UN, at least for the time being, over the last 2 years, with reference to its own history, ideals of nationhood, past democratic and constitutional practice, and processes of regional integration, however that Afghanistan, in the light of an ongoing insurgency, failed power sharing, contested political processes, and elections and contested histories, with no other common reference point other than its frequent struggle against various occupations, will most likely fail to fit peacefully in the near future. So far, my reading of 9/11-related events, failed intervention and state-building practice, and its impact on R2P. But to get back to emerging expert discourses and to strategic interests. 2 months ago, I attended a state-building conference in Birmingham that did not deal with the issue of R2P directly, but that, through its discussion of state-building, ruled out in many ways the possibility of its application. On one panel, a quantitative study funded by the U.S. Department of Defense tried to operationalize the revival of Islam and assess its impact on state-building based on the hypothesis that Islam, presumably more than other religions, would be harmful to the idea of democracy, leaving key questions of knowledge interest, dialogue between civilizations, and context explicitly aside. On a second panel that was entitled Critical Approaches to State Building, Paul Jackson reiterated a minimalist argument that has been around since the 1990s, that most, if not all, international interventions on state building were problematic, and so far as they did more harm than good, as they were imposed from the outside, while conceding that he would not know a way out of this theoretical dilemma that development agency in the field face on a daily basis. Another colleague, Richard Jackson, suggested a decentralized and demilitarized pacifist version of the state as a solution for world peace that would also rule out applications of R2P in the interim. All papers would have provided a good starting point for a presentation like this, since notion of prevention and recovery within the R2P framework seem only plausible through their wider reference to state and peace building. However, in the end, it was a paper by Mark Duffield that ultimately caught my attention insofar as it served as a stern reminder of how much seems to be at stake, as the last for the UN as the last normative line of defense and the crumbling and contested, more and more unipolar world order of preemptive strikes, targeted assassinations, and normative manipulation. The presentation that was very genuine, earth, however, in substance insofar, as it reduced the idea of an integrated UN planning approach that on paper basically just suggests to consider all problematic action taken within one interdependent context to the idea of business and virtual control, without individual normative content. The speaker concluded his plea against neoliberal peace building, a notion that was developed by authors like Cox and Richmond in a different context, with a picture of a supposed UN official at work in a pool with a mobile phone and a champagne cocktail. In a similar fashion, Aidan has noted in his most recent book a supposed lack of authentic, truthful, and normative meaningful practice involving UN member states and their obligations on the responsibility to protect, characterizing their behavior and moral advocacy as theatrics for public consumption, while criticizing UN and other R2P advocates for retreating to the arm of prevention rather than being proactive on the legal implementation and development of norms. He further quotes Chesterman's characterizing the semantic concepts of R2P as watered-down notion of linguistic conceit, which solely reaffirms the status quo and absence of a security council reform and reform of the present world order. All this reminds me very much of the mid-90s that saw a vibrant debate on whether NATO should be abolished. Only with the difference that post-9/11, NATO has found its raison d'etat in the defeat of terrorism, while the UN and its normative regimes are struggling to contain the subsequent damage in terms of generic mistrust and loss of certainty amidst mounting criticism, with no viable clearly stated alternatives that would be ready for implementation or member state endorsement, at least in the short term. Indeed, I would argue that its present struggle for relevance and meaning bears strong similarities to the dilemmas of integrated worldview construction at lower levels. The problematic is essentially the same. As a discourse theorist following Habermas and Gadamer, I believe not only in the vital importance of a codification of law, but also in the uncircumventable necessity to express and justify normative arguments that underline in the form of validity claims all forms of communication and cognition, and with the necessity of applied speech in the possibility of dialogue, moral advocacy, law, and peace. This school of thought that was developed as part of a wider discipline of sociology of law is commonly known as universal pragmatics. It's claimed that the First Speech Act already contains the promise of a universal association has become the founding principle for post-Kantian cosmopolitanism. As a consequence, I value the responsibility to protect as a core principle of international ethics, regardless of conceptual or political differences or conflicting arguments with regard to its factual implementation. Any effort to negate its necessity and substance within the debate on international ethics or reform or of the international world order, as Aidan suggests, would, in my view, constitute a performative contradiction. Insofar as it would simultaneously seek to criticize an ideal, it would seek to uphold in one form or the other in a different context. For example, through the condemnation against crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing. This being said, I'm also painfully aware of the necessity of ideology critique and procedural shortcomings in terms of accountability. It is in this context I'm speaking of the necessity of applied idealism, a notion that would be very different from Weiss's overtly optimistic UN reform demand and sought on the world government, but not incompatible, insofar as it would not only acknowledge the value of ideal-typical assumptions, but argue for their uncircumventable necessity as part of processes of mediation and cross-cultural dialogic reasoning. My model would further differ from other critical emancipatory approaches insofar as it would still seek to uphold the idea of RTP and argue that its critics confuse failed action and systemic intrusion with the notion of RTP itself, when they argue that the latter would be an expression of narrow and liberal interpretations of human security that would preclude an application of a cosmopolitan ethics from the ground up that could strengthen human security practice. Calls for post-colonial ethics of non-hegemonic engagement, as put forward, for example, by Takbash, that should reflect local responsibilities and perception of dignity and local social and customary practice in relation to international peace-building norms to promote human security are, like the Safar example has shown, valid. They just have to be understood as a complementary process within a larger cross-cultural dialogical framework, similar to that Linklater has developed in recent years. I will get back to this in a moment. Ideally, RTP, and I think I probably missed a slide here. Ideally, RTP should find its expression in a universal and standardized format of enforcement, justification, and obligation. It would, however, not only require culturally sensitive ethics of action at the local level, but also check and balances at the international level to avoid scenarios in which a third party for example, could simply topple a government by funding political convenient opposition forces that then might misuse a broader notion of RTP for the strategic agenda, something that is at present not ruled out, not even through the moral threshold of the six principles that the ICSS outlined. As Sir Roberts has noted, any world in which there is a dominant power is bound to see a considerable interest in interventionism. An independent expanded judicial framework to enforce extended obligations like Aidan suggests would make sense at the conceptual level. However, might be problematic at the practical level in light of the fact that at present a majority of the Security Council members have not ratified the ICC statute. Judging from my interaction in the field of military actors, I also believe that the long-awaited UN standing force, as foreseen in Article 43 of the UN Charter, would likely be an illusion within the present international order unless the UN would decide to build its own army from scratch and would not rely on secondments that bring with them a multitude of problems in terms of command structure, group dynamics, and pressure. It would need to socialize its own force according to a particular set of solidarity principles that would need to be internalized to an extent where previous national identifications would not matter. In this context, I would disagree with Kaiser's thought on cosmopolitan agency. For a soldier to become a universal legitimate bearer of arms who would fight for humanity, it would not necessarily require a cultural transformation in terms of duties or rights of citizenship, as she suggests. Every adult can understand and act upon post-conventional principles, but it would require a reform of existing national military resocialization practice that probably first would have to be abolished before it could be meaningfully resuscitated in a more solidarist form. However, aside from the question on how to best implement further reaching obligations, applied idealism would start off by looking at power relations and scope for agency within the present academic discourse that ultimately impacts on knowledge creation. It would aim to critically engage other forms of scholarship and relevant discipline by pointing out discursive fallacies that are also inherent in aspects of legal practice, Often, ironically, not unlike the U.S. military in the above-cited examples, simply retaliates by seeking to win an argument, by allowing for a complete background of communication and its mutual accusation of an ability to speak meaningfully, rather than trying to achieve a consensus on game-changing principles that are based on a shared need for a sustainable world order and inclusive dialogue on power relations and consequent distorted notions of truth, justice, and authenticity. Dialogue that is aimed at prevention and that is initiated through moral advocacy. And here, the difference. You believe in enforcement, I believe in moral advocacy. Another relevant field would be the post-structural discourse of IRR theory that combines many concerns of critical approaches, often asserting the principle of pacifism of doing no harm. From a field perspective, it appears that the post-structural approaches often simply reside in the light of silence and violated meaning, or are deprived of their normative ability of standard setting and fear of violations of the cultural other, while often leaving the multidimensional systemic and lively interconnectedness of peace-building processes and the individual need for empowerment amid suspicion concerning an alienated expression of an imposed Western self, and dialectic processes of resistance aside. A connectedness that is very described in Linklater's latest book, The Problem of Harm in World Politics, that develops with the principle of doing no harm a lowest cosmopolitan denominator for cross-cultural dialogue and higher forms of collective moral learning that might one day also lead to a collective legitimization of interventions based on shared normative convictions rather than self-interest. Vivian Jarvie's notion of a post-colonial subject would be a good example for such post-structural thought, which is not to say that many of her concerns are not spot on and that processes of empowerment cannot be strategically manipulated. They can and are. Starting from the assumptions of a hegemony of a liberal peace, she proceeds to understand Western intervention as social engineering in this position of local agency, requiring a new effort of reclaimed subjectivity and self-determination. While it's true that at practical level it might be difficult to understand why a local warlord or rural communities might be victims of a neoliberal peace. After reformulating Jarvie's argument on a meta level of colonialized worldviews and expert discourses on self-determination, it becomes apparent why her argument actually fits in very well with core assumptions of the above outlined approach. Her and other critiques of neoliberalism echo an old insight of Marx and Weber at the meta level, that technical and strategic learning processes precede moral learning, hence the danger of alienation and importance of worldview formation. Nevertheless, by becoming either a dominant force that retaliates and alienates for the sake of winning, or by solely taking perspective of a presumed victim of colonization, both of the above-mentioned legal and post-structural voices often leave the actual policy discourse to others, many realist and power brokers of national interest who think only in short-term frames of elections and benefit from failed normative communication processes in the leftist quarter globally. Applied idealism starts with a very simple observation that by ceasing to act communicatively and proactively, any critique will be unable to contribute to the reversal of the present and expanding systemic colonization of culture-specific forward-looking expert discourses and cultural livelihoods that is ongoing through systemic forces of money, security, and power. Those very discourses and meaning resources that are, according to Weber, the main catalysts for a transformation of integrated worldviews, it should be the main reference point for empowerment and the development of new policies and processes and subsequent systemic stabilization. While every political system will eventually degenerate and bring about change as a result of its need for conceptual adaptation, it is the absence of the later planning stage in thinking within wars and revolutions and one for local stabilization process of integrated worldview formation that is systematically misunderstood and contributes to the creation of weak states and autocratic states. Linklater knows in a different context that nation states possess grand narratives that world society needs to match to remain relevant. I would argue that while such a cosmopolitan worldview would be desirable, it must not preclude narrative formation or integration at local levels. Ideas like RTP that are counterfactual insofar as they are not fully realized have a distinct value insofar as they enable communication and force parties to engage in dialogic processes of justification that they normally would seek to avoid. Based on shared human experience, they specified stepping stones for dialogue between civilizations and future shared normative beliefs. At the same time, it's worth keeping in mind that the present scope for action depends on the international order that mitigates national interests, that if further unleashed through the abolishment of a veto for reform, or even the inclusion of a permanent or more permanent member states, may through strategic coalitions in the long term create more inequality, uncertainty, conflict, and undermine the principles of the UN Charter even more than creating additional normative commitments. Reform requires innovative and detailed thought on prevention prior to its implementation that takes complementary needs for change and subsequent systemic stabilization at all levels into account, and is also aware of pitfalls in terms of ideological manipulation. Put simply, critical theory-based is of value to the RTP debate insofar as it can contextualize the notion further as part of a further reaching discourse analysis that could help to shape policies of prevention. It could develop new dimensions of its practical application through a very established body of work in terms of discourse ethics, cognitive psychology, sociology of law, and IR theory. The latter provide insights that might be helpful with regard to further specification of negotiation and mediation tools and communicative strategies for normative advocacy and capacity building at the local, national, regional, and international level. In this context, one would have to differentiate between like-minded critical approaches like Linklaters that acknowledge the value of universal pragmatics but hope for procedural shortcuts, and other cosmopolitan approaches such as Kairos, who argue that cosmopolitan agency, for example that of a cosmopolitan soldier, is a distant possibility, and instrumentalist approaches like Patterson simultaneously incorporate and negate cosmopolitan beliefs. By now it should be clear why a moderate instrumentalist approach to RTP like Patterson's that seeks to derive legitimacy from a prospective effectiveness of interventions and self-interest driven action rather than genuine humanitarian intention and interaction would signify a contradiction in terms. Patterson's approach fails to understand the fundamental difference between instrumental and strategic and more practical knowledge interests and the function of law and livelihoods as venue for social integration, which explains his ultimate conclusion that NATO and not the UN would be in most cases the most legitimate intervener. However, I hope to have shown that through my previous discussion that prospects of succeeding humanitarian action and creation of solid nations and state structures appear to depend more on the integrative imagination of worldview constructing local and regional experts that military actors would find very difficult to relate to as a result of competing strategic, normative and communicative interests. Best expressed in the above-mentioned commission study of the U.S. Ministry of Defense, which leaves the ball very much in the court of the UN and expert discourses. To end on a practical note, that might be less contentious than the court, which is one suggestion of Aidan. It would make sense to appoint indigenous expert discourses that could also include religious scholars at an early stage of an intervention who could liaise with other actors on the wider task of perception peace building and nation building with special emphasis on integrative cultural and legal practice. This could happen in conjunction with other consultative processes on constitutions and elections, a task that the UN, despite the Peace Building Commission, as a result of its technocratic focus, is still ill-equipped for. As an example for best practice in this regard would be the very successful inter-religious council in Sierra Leone. In this context, it might be useful to consider a different format for final communiques, for example in terms of polyphone text. But this would be an entirely different discussion. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks. Can I open it up to questions?